Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Ask the Industry podcast, episode 84. I'm comedian Simon Kane, and for those of you new to the show, this is the podcast where I interview the most influential people from the worlds of stand-up, comedy, radio, and today, podcasting. Well, that's actually underselling him. He is influential on the stand-up circuit, on the touring circuit, on the writing circuit, and in podcasting. Richard Herring is a comedian, writer, and podcasting pioneer. He's been performing comedy for over 25 years and is known for his strong work ethic and his drive to perform, taking a new show to the Edinburgh Fringe every year for a decade, and then extensively touring it. We talked about how he juggles and manages so many different projects, as well as his family, his anxiety, and a bit of mental health stuff concerning his downtime, as well as his latest show, which follows on from The Best Show, and how that's playing on his mind with audiences' expectations of what they're going to get after a show that he's actively toured and said is his best stuff. I loved it. I think if you're interested in podcasting or building an audience online, or if you just want to hear how a comedian deals with pre-show jitters on a tour show that didn't sell very well, those are his words, not mine, you're in the right place. I just really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed talking to him and getting some information about what it's like producing content, putting it up there for free, and the weird act of faith that you have to go through to hope that people will give you their attention, because that is currency in this day and age. That is the most important thing, which is why I'm going to keep this intro as short as possible. If you're listening to this when this has come out, myself and Richard are both at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, which starts in a few days' time. So if you'd like to see his show, he is at the Pleasance Courtyard every single day at 7:30 p.m. doing a show called Oh Frig, I'm 50. And if you'd like to see me, I am at Sweets Venue at 5 p.m. every single day except Wednesdays, when I am rudely awakened by the dust. Oh God, that's going to get old by the end of the Fringe with my flyering technique. But it's every day except Wednesday when I get rudely awoken by the dustman. If you want to reserve a seat for mine, it's £5, or you can pay what you want on exit. And Richard's prices vary on the day, depending on what day you go and see him or whether it's a 2-for-1 thing. So if you have a look in the show notes, you'll be able to see all that information. But for now, this is Richard Herring.
The reason I began podcasting was because we sort of realised how easy it was. I'd done a radio show with Andrew Collings, and I'd sort of come on and done half an hour with him about the papers in his Six Music show. And then that ended, and we'd sort of missed it. I'm thinking we hadn't done it for a year. We'd always enjoyed doing them. And then he basically did a podcast for Word magazine and realised that you just needed a computer and a nerd. And so we thought, oh, it might be fun to do it. And I think initially we sort of probably thought, hey, look, if we do this and people hear it, they might give us a radio show again, which did eventually happen. But then I sort of quickly, I think, realised that it was just more about the, you know, the freedom to do whatever you wanted to do. So kind of quite, well, I think we started quite sensibly, and then about episode 3 or 4, I called his mum a fucking idiot. And from there on in, it was sort of realising the freedom to, you know, it was very much the Wild West, you could say what you wanted, and I think you sort of still can, really. And it's uncensored, and no one's arbitrating it apart from yourself. So I kind of like that autonomy of it, and I kind of recognised that it was, I had loads of ideas for stuff, and you sort of tried to do them on radio and TV, and even if you're successful, it takes ages, and often someone interferes and ruins it, and then, you know, or it doesn't happen at all. So it's just the immediacy of being able to do something really easily and put it up was what appealed to me, I think, initially.
Yeah, because you'd always done radio and TV up to that point.
Yeah.
So you've sort of seen it from both sides.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I'd done lots of TV and radio in the 90s, and then, you know, I was still doing stuff in the... I started podcasting in 2008, I think. It was, because it was the... I sort of met my wife, and me and Andrew started podcasting in more or less the same month. So it's nearly 10 years ago. Yeah, it just I was still doing radio shows and the odd bit of telly, but it just felt like I was having lots of ideas that weren't being picked up, but that I thought were good ideas. And also, I can't quite remember the timing of it, but it was around about the time that the Saxgate thing happened as well, and then the radio got very edgy about anything. Even like I remember doing a panel show and them saying, don't swear during the warm-up in case there's a Daily Mail journalist in who will, you know, give the BBC a hard time. So the BBC were so frightened of anything that could be a bit controversial. So to be able to do something, you know, so with As It Occurs to Me, which was a couple of years down the line of doing stuff, I just thought, oh, this is great. I've got the freedom to do whatever I wanted. But actually, with that freedom, you kind of quickly go, oh, actually, you know, there's no fun in it if you're allowed to do it. So you sort of can't, you know, you calm down a little bit and create your own parameters. But it was all those things. But it mainly, you know, I wasn't getting overwhelmed with work, and I was struggling a bit to do the work that people wanted me to do, and I didn't quite know what direction I wanted to go in with my career. So I was doing stand up again, and I just, it felt more like stand up. You know, stand up's great because you just come up with an idea and you go and do it. And then if the audience like it, it's successful. And if they don't, it's not. And I kind of like that about comedy, that it's sort of self-perpetuating and self-regulating. It's got its own barometer. You know, it's probably the only job in which you're assessed every single night you do it as a stand-up comedian. So the podcast felt like the same sort of thing, really. So initially it was with Andrew, and then, you know, I thought well, there must be more scope. I still feel there's a lot more scope to podcasts than really anyone's doing. Maybe the Americans are starting a little bit more, but... I think, you know, you can sort of do your own TV and radio shows of any kind, you know, whereas it is mainly people chatting.
Yeah. No, yeah. I was thinking about that before, where because you started sort of, you're sort of always looked at as quite a pioneer of podcasting, but you sort of started in 2008, and obviously it was around a lot longer before then. So were there any podcasts you were listening to that kind of made you think, this is so easy to do?
I didn't really listen to podcasts before, and I didn't really know much about them. So I knew they existed, and I've subsequently, Ricky Gervais's one was the kind of probably the first one that people really got behind, which I then, you know, I did listen to some of that, and it's really good. But no, it was just, you know, it was just, we realised we could do it, and it felt like a bit of fun. And then, as it went on, I realised there was a lot more to it than just it being fun and being a way of, I've been writing a blog since 2002, which is, you know, again, not quite the first person to do it, but certainly, you know, amongst the first people to do it, and certainly one of the rare people who carries on doing it, certainly every single day. You know, that was a good... I felt like when I started doing that, I thought, well, this would be a good way to get people to come to the website every day and be able to publicise my stuff. And I suppose with podcasts, I sort of quickly realised you've got an audience there. And we quickly kind of got into the iTunes top 10. And, we're amazed to see us coming first in the iTunes top 10, which is, you know, I don't quite understand how they judge it. But, of course, there wasn't all that much competition back then. But it meant that everyone was... everyone who listened to podcasts was sort of listening to us. Or lots of people were, and I sort of very quickly noticed when I was touring, my numbers were suddenly, you know, doubling from the quite small numbers. We're going back in time a bit today because we're in Radlett, where I've hardly sold any tickets, so this is a bit like a 2008 gig. But I'd do a lot of gigs for 30 or 50 people. And then within 2 or 3 years of starting the podcast, A, you'd meet loads of people who go, oh, I love the podcast. And your audience would be 100 to 200 or 300, 400, you know. So it really helped, along with other things, it really helped build up an audience. And I kind of realised it was a sensible, I've sort of realised subsequently it's a sort of sensible business decision. But I'm not a businessman. I never thought of it like that. I kind of thought, I've just got idea. Some people go, well, why would you give stuff out for free? And you go, hey, well, it's just dicking around. So it's not like... And in that dicking around, we created... You know, like Hit the Moustache came out of at Collins and Herring podcast where I suddenly decided to scare him by having a Hitler moustache for no reason. And then we started discussing that, and then that became that show, you know. So it was a great way of generating material. It was great way of generating an audience. And then, you know, you give something away for free, and then people generally will feel embarrassed after 100 hours of it and give you a pound.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that's actually... But then I sort of realised that's all you need, and that's what... if the podcast could really work, and it still doesn't quite work like this, if everyone who listened gave me a pound a year or a pound a month, I could do absolutely any, you know, I could create anything I wanted to. I could be doing movies, basically, if I got a pound a month from everyone who listened, you know. So, and that doesn't seem unreasonable for, you know, 25p an hour or something, you know. So, yeah. I think that's still, and I feel that will still happen with podcasts or some internet-based entertainment. It feels like, you know, it felt very much 5 or 6 years ago like this could be the beginning of the movie industry. You know, someone's going to be the Charlie Chaplin who gets a dime off every single person who sees his film and is a millionaire within a year. And, you know, obviously that's happening on YouTube and things like that, but generally from people being sponsored rather than ever. You know, if you could find a way of making the listeners understand, if they would all just give a tiny little throwback to you, even if it was 10p, you know, every time they listen, then that would lead to be able to do amazing stuff. But it's sort of gradually, you know, I've managed one way or another to fund things.
But
initially, well, I just didn't care about the money. I didn't care. I just thought this is great. I've got I've got a platform to do comedy. But then I suddenly realised, hey, this is, you know, A, I'm getting more people coming to see me on tour. B, you know, in 2009, 2010, I started getting invited back on all the panel shows. In fact, not invited back, I was never really on them before, you know. So I was on Buzzcocks and Have I Got News For You and stuff because of the podcast, I think, you know. So it led to other work. And it just, you know, and I think it sort of does work as a... I didn't think about it too much, and I sort of still don't think about it too much for fear that I will ruin it if I think about it too much. But you know, it does sort of work. Accidentally is a great business model because, you know, most people are decent at the end of the day. But what I like about it as well is that, or you know, almost socialist thing about it is that it's free. Everyone can listen to it, and people who can afford to pay should maybe pay a little bit for it. But that's why I've never got into really charging people at source, because I want everyone to be able to listen to it, if, you know, even if they can't afford to pay for it.
It's about value giving online, which is sort of the thing that I think traditional outlets are kind of losing out on at the moment, because they're sort of chasing clickbait. They're not sort of trying to provide any form of value, which is why indie creators are actually making better content in some instances than some of the more established.
Yeah, well, you know, but you've got, that's, as a creative person, you're always fighting against that. You know, that wall of executives that in a TV channel or a radio channel, you know, who telling you that you need this sort of thing or that sort of thing or want this sort of thing or don't want that kind of person. So what I love about it is, you know, if you're not in Vogue or if you've got ideas that that wouldn't work on TV, like playing yourself at snooker endlessly, then you can still do them, you know. So that as a creative person, it gives you the opportunity to try stuff. And you know, and that it just depends. If you want to be paid, and if you want to be famous, podcasts probably aren't the way to go. But if you want to be creative and you want your stuff to be out there, and if I just sort of realised with stand up, you know, all I care about, I didn't care about thousands of people coming to see me. All I care about is having an outlet to do that, do my stuff. So if 10 people are coming to see me in a little pub, I'm still able to perform to them, and that's enough for me. And so it's. Not that I wouldn't perform to 3,000 people if 3,000 people ever wanted to come and see me, but you know, so just I think it was realizing that there's this outlet for stuff, and you know, it's your own channel, and it's incredible. When we started in the 1990s, if you wanted a radio show, you had to work and get a radio show, and you know, we somehow managed to do that, but God knows how we did it. And and then, you know, you would do 20 radio shows and be judged on those, but now you can do 1,000 radio shows of your own and put them out and learn and get better and, you know, and do whatever you want to do. So, you know, it means people can no longer sort of do, it's that thing, isn't it, people go, oh, I'm writing a novel but no one will ever publish it. But, you know, now you can do everything yourself, so there's no excuse.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
It's back.
It is.
Well, no, I was going to ask, because your podcasts are so different to your sort of idea-driven show, because they're so specific. Do you find that you get people coming and sort of not enjoying it because they were expecting the podcast, or they were expecting
something
like
that? I think more they come expecting not to enjoy it that much and think it's better than they thought it was. I think they think it's going to be, because the podcast is so slapdash,
yeah,
and the character play on the podcast is largely, you know, either just childish or, you know, deliberately not funny, or, you know, or there's lots of sort of levels to what I'm doing, but it's a different thing than I'm doing in my stand-up. So I usually find people who come to see the stand-up are just sort of surprised how good I am at stand-up. Mm. Because again, you know, like if you listen to the Less Square Theatre podcast, I think you've got to understand the distinction. You know, you can't compare like a podcast to a TV show with loads of writers and loads of time and loads of budget. But also, most of my podcast stuff is pretty much either entirely improvised or written the day before. So any stand-up I do at the beginning of the Leicester Square Theatre podcast is literally me making something up in the moment. You know, I might have thought, maybe I'll try and talk about that, I'll try and talk about that. It's the way you write a stand-up show, but you don't usually broadcast the first time you try that stuff. So, you know, a lot of those things will fail, and then some people go, oh, I've heard Richard Herring stand-up on the Leicester Square Theatre podcast, and it's not very good. Yeah. But then if you came and see me do a home show, you would hopefully go, oh, that is good. So, yeah, I don't think, you know, I think maybe sometimes people are wanting to you to do Ham Hands and whatever and Shreks and stuff, which I don't really do in any of my life stuff. But, my audiences have always been really great and interesting and clever people, which I'm very lucky about. And that's, you know, there's loads of things I think as a younger man I was more ambitious, and you want to be that big star and you want to have thousands of people come to see you and loads of money, and then actually you sort of realise I'd rather have this sort of tight group of, you know, a small number of people that it seems to be growing, but who you come, and if other acts are on with me, they go, your audiences are so lovely, they, you know, they get comedy and they're not cunts. And you know, so in a way, you know, by doing it really slowly and building up this audience, I've got a lovely audience to play to who kind of get where I'm coming from, you know. And even if you know that, and are surprised rather than being disappointed, it's not like the podcast, I'd surprised and delighted that it's something a little bit different than the podcast.
I think a lot of people perceive it as, because you've been going quite a long time by the time you started podcasting, that you were quite established, which meant that you kind of had a leg up on some people starting. Would you say that was fair?
I don't think it's a little bit fair, but not really. Because, like, we didn't, you know, I think that's in terms of popularity. Lee and Herring, we toured and not hardly anyone came to see us. We weren't well known. So, if anything, I had to slightly, you know, and I was playing much more of a character in Lee and Herring than Stuart was. And I, you know, I had to sort of overcome that and find the real me, or, you know, another real me, another character of me. But also, I just don't, you know, I don't think it's borne out. I was touring to 30 people coming to see me at gigs. You know, it was better than nothing, but it wasn't a huge groundswell of people. Yeah, I mean, you know, I came out to do stand-up, and there was a small advantage of I'd just, you know, I'd been on TV 4 years before, and so people wanted to give me gigs. And yeah, maybe to a certain extent, it helped you build up an audience a little bit, but I don't think it's that big a difference, and I think you can do it. Even so, you know, and I've been doing podcasts for 10 years, and it hasn't, you know, it's only led to more podcasts, which I'm happy with because I'm enjoying them. But you know, it's not like I'm not on most people's radars, and I never was on most people's radars. Even when people would see me as being successful, we never won awards. We were never in that in crowd. We never invited, you know, I was never invited onto panel shows. Never invited to act in other people's things. No one ever came to see us live, really. So, you know, I think we were like a minor success. But yeah, maybe in podcast terms, that was enough to give me, you know, I suppose more successful people wouldn't be doing podcasts at that time, and less successful people might find it more difficult to get an audience. But I also think if you do a good podcast, people will find out about it pretty quickly. And, you know, and you can build up from nothing with a podcast, but also learn what you do. You know, in a way, you don't want people to hear your early podcasts.
Yeah,
I think, you know, if you're a 20-year-old kid starting out, a young person starting out, and you know, you're still finding your feet. I'm delighted the stuff I did when I'm 20 isn't available freely online. You know, some of it's around if you really struggle to find it, but you know, it's you make mistakes. So. Yeah, you know, I mean, it was good. Probably the main thing was I had, 15 years of being a professional comedian was probably more useful than any fame I had, which was minor, I think.
If you were starting again now, what would you do differently?
As a pod, in podcasting?
Yeah.
I would be 20 years younger than I was when I started. You know, I think that's all I think about is it's a very long, but I think, again, most of a creative career is this, is, you know, it's a long game, and it's not just about being successful very quickly. It's not about being lauded, really. It's about learning how to do what you're doing. So I kind of, my only regret about podcasts is that I didn't, wasn't able to start doing them 10 or 15 years earlier, because I think it would have given you, I think I'm going to run out of steam and run out of runway, because I'll be dead. Whereas, you know, I think someone starting at 20, I think could have a 20-year career that then blossoms into something like amazing. But after I've been doing podcasts for 20 years, I'll be, you know, 60. Mm. So, you know, I might still be podcasting, but I think it gets harder to build up the energy and time to do it, I suppose. So I don't know. I think even the things that don't work and the mistakes you make, I think, are just sort of vitally important in learning what to do. So there's no point saying I wish I hadn't done that, because by doing that thing that was bad or that didn't work, you learnt a lesson that you wouldn't have learnt if you hadn't done the thing. Mm. So all the ups and downs kind of help to make you what you are, and hopefully make you better at what you're doing. So can't think of anything. The thing I regret most about my career is not doing stand-up earlier, really. And so it's the same thing. I didn't like doing stand-up, and if I'd just persisted through my 20s at doing stand-up, I'd have had 10 more years of being a stand-up before I then started being a stand-up again and would be better at it, you know. So that's all. I think just having had more time to do it would be good. But, you know, hopefully I will live till I'm 100, and then I will have had enough runway to, you know, it's the potential. I'm not good at networking. I'm not good at pushing myself. The thing I have that, aside from maybe not being talented enough, that means my career doesn't go as well as some other people's in those terms, is that I think I sort of believe things should work on fairness. And I have that kind of sense of decency that I think it should be, you should work and it should be your turn, and you should, and if you're good, you will get noticed. Whereas actually, you know, the people who push themselves and are ambitious and say, hey, I'm great, look at me, I'm clever and great, you must come and see me, actually end up doing better than the people sitting back going, oh, people will realise I'm good if I sit back and just do, if I just am good for 20 years, people will realise that I'm good. But it doesn't really work that way. So, yeah. You know, maybe I'd be more pushy, but if I was more pushy, I wouldn't be who I am. So, you know, and it really suits me, and it especially suits me now. I would, 10, 20 years ago, I would have wanted something different. I would have looked at this and gone, oh, that's sad and pathetic. But, you know, I would rather be known by a small amount of people who really like what I'm doing and get what I'm doing, and, you know, and you walk down the street, if they recognize you, it's hey, hello, rather than be known by millions of people, most of whom don't really know who you are or don't really like you that much. So you walk down the street and you go, is that what, wanker, fuck you, you know. You do gigs and half the people are just coming to see because you're on the telly, and then you do something a bit esoteric or weird and then they're angry. So you know, it's worked out very well in creative terms, and I make a very nice living, and I create nearly all my own work, and I have a kind of anonymity in the real world, which I really value. Because, you know, I've got a child now, and just being out with your child, you don't want to be the centre of attention, you know. You don't want to, you know, don't want your fun time with your family to be interrupted by loads of people coming up and going, I think you're funny. So that doesn't happen, so it's fine. Occasionally someone goes, I'm listening to you now. Which is weird for them.
Well, you make a lot of content.
Yes, I do.
And you put it all out pretty immediately, yeah, or very quickly after you've made it. Do you find like you're good with like downtime, or you're good with like taking breaks, and how do you not get burnt out?
It's difficult not to get burnt out. I think sometimes I do get burnt out, and I have been burnt out at times. And I'm not very good at downtime. But I kind of, you know, I like my job, and my job is my hobby at the same time. So it's just, the difficulty is when suddenly, you know, like actually, just as this year, at the start of this year, we're doing As It Occurs to Me, which was a massive undertaking, you know, a crazy undertaking, really. I should never have done it. It was great. We got kind of £100,000 from Kickstarter to do it, which was amazing. But that's not enough to pay myself anything for doing any of the writing of it. And there's a lot of writing of it and a lot of work in it, and for everyone. And then we, you know, Channel 4 picked up and wanted to do a taste tape of a sitcom I'd written for them. And Radio 4 wanted me to write a sitcom for them. And I was on tour and I was doing, you know, all the other stuff. And the Less Wet Theatre podcast and everything, you know, coming out. And it was just like crazily too much stuff. But in a way that I quite enjoyed, to be honest. But it was just like, that was nuts. So it's, you know, you just have to, and I've got a family and I want to make sure that I'm there for my family and I'm making sure that I'm not working all the time. So, but you know, you're self-employed, so you have to, certainly when the paid work comes in, you have to sort of take that. When it comes up, you can't go, oh no, actually, sorry, because two things have come at once, I'm going to turn down this this opportunity. So, you know, it's difficult, but I also... And I have lots of ideas, and I'm, you know, and I'm happy to churn it out. And I think that's why the internet's good, because, and it may be bad as well, because it means I can churn the stuff out. And maybe in some ways it might be better for me to take one idea and really work it up beautifully and present it somewhere. But that can't really work on the internet, because I can't keep on doing that. I can't spend 8 months creating one thing. And with As It Occurs to Me, I spent 8 months creating, you know, 8 hours of comedy. So it's not, there's still the same ethos of just chucking shit at the walls and hoping it sticks. But, you know, I think you have to do that. And then with the paid stuff, I can, you know, with the stand-up shows and with the scripts I'm writing for the telly, then I can take a bit more time to make them, you know, what I would do if I had time to do something. So if someone's paying me a little bit, so yeah, I think I like what I'm doing, and I'm kind of have a lot of ideas. But occasionally, you know, when I wrote Time, Gentlemen, Please, which was the sitcom I did for Sky, I did 37 episodes in 2 years, and it sort of, I worked really, really hard on it, got paid really well, but also no one really watched it, and no, the reviews were sniffy, and I'd really put my heart and soul into it. And then you sort of, and we'd done Lee and Herring, same thing. We'd worked so hard on it, and people never, you know, we didn't really ever reach those, you know, those levels of critical success and award success, which sort of mattered to me at the time when it wasn't happening. And so, you know, then you get to the point where, why am I doing, you know, what's the point of doing this, and why am I working so hard, and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, I'm actually now just at the point where I'm doing stuff because I really want to do it, and stuff that I really like. And you know, you've just got to, I think my career's gone on long enough that I appreciate when you're fortunate, and it isn't necessarily when people think it is, you know. And in fact, being successful and being rich aren't necessarily great things, whereas being able to do what you want to do and being happy in what you're doing is much more important. So, you know, even when I'm busy, even when I'm thinking, fuck, I'm doing all this stuff and I have to rush down the country and record this sitcom, you think, how lucky am I? You know, how many writers and comedians would like to be in the position I'm in? How many comedians would love to come to Radlett and perform to 60 people, you know? Which I can be sniffy about, because now I do better than that most places. But then every now and then you just check yourself and go, you know, you've got to appreciate what you've got. So, you know, I'm incredibly lucky to be able to do this as a job. I'm incredibly lucky that anyone wants to listen to any of this stupid rubbish I put out. You know, and I've been doing this job for 30 years and never really had a time where people haven't been interested in what I'm doing, or where I haven't been making enough money to live. And so, you know, I think you just sort of appreciate it. So I don't really get, you know, I just sort of see it as, I feel grateful for the... for the opportunity. And you know, I've got to write an Edinburgh show this year as well, and you know, there's a part of me thinking, I haven't got any ideas, and maybe this is it, maybe it's over, which is very difficult when you're coming off another show, where especially this show, which is like the best material I've got and the most honed routines I've got, you're going to go, how the fuck did I write that stuff? As I write at the start, it's very difficult to you know, create that stuff, so you worry about the ideas drying up. But you know, I think it's still, that's why I think to keep churning stuff out is helpful, because you sort of think, well, look, I'm creating all this stuff and 70% of it's all right, you know, and maybe 20% of it's better than all right. So
yeah, I think that anxiety of potentially not having an idea, especially at this point in the year when Edinburgh's looming, is something that most performers kind of go through. Yeah. I mean, you must be kind of used to it in a way by now, because you did Edinburgh for, was it 11 years in a row?
Yeah, I mean, I've done it, but I've done 40, this will be my 40th Edinburgh show this year. So yeah, I've done it a lot of times, but it never goes away, because you never, you know, you always think, you think, oh, I'd probably be all right. but you can never be sure. And then you know, the older you get, you think, what if I just stop being funny? Or so at the beginning, you think, you know, I've had a great show, but what if I never have another funny idea? So, you know, you've got to be like, that's human. And you need to, if you didn't think like that, that would be worse. You know, it'd be worse. You think, yes, I'll definitely be fantastic. The last two or three Edinburgh shows I've written have been so easy to write and have come together so fast. Partly because I just think I've done it so many times, I know what I'm doing. And, yeah, you know, partly because I've had been quite inspired by things. You know, at the moment, I'm not feeling massively inspired for new stand-up. But you know, everything. You know, I've actually had a very fecund period with writing the sitcoms and thinking, as it occurs to me, it's going to be good as well. So, you know, I'm not too worried about it.
Mm. No, I wouldn't be.
Not yet. We'll see. You know, and I think that's but also you just get, there's loads of times, oh, this is terrible. And, you know, as it occurs to me, loads of time, I've got nothing. But the humiliation of that's what's, you know, actually the podcasts are good because, you know they're going out to people. And so you can't, you know, as much as you can dick around and do some rubbish and half-assed bits in it, you have to make it good. So, you know, that fear of failure is what sort of drives you on to hopefully not fail.
So you're going back to, you took off last year from Edinburgh, was it?
I've taken two years off.
And what's making you go back? Like, do you feel like you need to do Edinburgh still?
No, I don't think, you know, I think those 2 years off showed I don't need to do it, because I wrote a brand new show without going to Edinburgh, and that was what I thought I needed Edinburgh for. But it's my 30th anniversary. It's part of the reason I want to do, like, a, you know, I did a show called Oh Fuck, I'm 40, and I'm 50 this year, so it felt like I should go to Edinburgh to do that show. And, you know, it wasn't like I was saying I'm never doing Edinburgh, but I think, you know, I don't think it's massively useful for me, really. You know, I realised I was better off in terms of just doing my show whenever I wanted to do it, because all I'm doing is putting myself up against loads of competition and, you know, and in a very economically stupid way of doing a show. Whereas if I do it on my own in London at any time I want, then, you know, I'll make money as I do it. So, you know, there's loads of reasons not to do it. But I really like Edinburgh and it's fun. And having had a couple of years off, I'm sort of ready to give it another crack, I think. I had a bad year up there the last time, but also it was good because I was taking a couple of big chances and they didn't really pay off. But I'm glad that I took the chance, you know. So I lost loads of money doing a play and the stand-up show was on late and didn't do as well as usual, even though I think it was a really good show. So, you know, it's difficult, but then, I still love Edinburgh, and I think it's given me so much, and you get so much out of it, really, I think, anyway, just in terms of seeing other stuff. But I think it does pay for itself. You know, you can say, oh, I lost £40,000 this year, but I've made money other years, but also you've made money through getting work other years and having ideas and learning what you're doing. So, you know, it's good to have something to focus on and go, hey, I've got to, you know, I think, again, if I wasn't doing Edinburgh this year, I think I might struggle to write a show because I think, well, what am I working towards, you know? Mm. But now I've got to have a show by August, so, you know, and I've said I'll do it, so I've got to do it. I kind of wish I hadn't now.
It's just, yeah, it's a good yardstick. I think most comedians, like, work to that, like, year to year.
Yeah.
And I know you did for like, sort of, you did 11 one-man shows.
I did, like, 11 years in a row, but I did every year. I missed 5 years in total until I had these 2 years off. So I've missed 7 years since 1987, you know, but I'd basically, three of those were early 90s. So from 1992 onwards, I missed two Edinburghs in however many years that is. So it's, so I'd missed three, I think, and then I missed two. I missed 2000 and 2002, and then I was still doing shows every year. So I did Christ on a Bike in 2001, I think, was it, or 2000? And then Talking Cock, and then had a year off. 2001, 2002, and then had a year off. So, you know, I was doing one-man shows. So I've done 12 one-man shows in 15 years, and two of them I did again. I did the second time. So I did Christ and Mike and Talking Cock again, just so I could get them on DVD, really.
If you were starting now, so if you were back when you were, maybe when you were starting as a solo performer rather than as a double act,
yeah,
would you have gone to Edinburgh if it was 2017 when you were starting that?
I mean, I would, because I think what the thing is about Edinburgh is really is better for new people, and what it is about learning how to do the job again. It's the same thing. So it's better that Edinburgh has no value in terms of making you successful, because you should be going to Edinburgh for 5 or 6 years and just trying stuff out. And that's what we did to begin with. It was just there was less people around, so if you did something quite good, you got noticed quite quickly. And, you know, we did get noticed through Edinburgh, through other things. But I think it's better, you know, something like the Free Fringe, go to Edinburgh, don't spend too much money, make lots of friends, see what other people are doing, and learn how to do the job. Because however good you think you are, and even if you're brilliant, you'll get better by doing.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It for 20 years. So if you spend, you know, I think, like, I just think as young comedians, and I was the same, you go, oh, well, you know, wouldn't it be great if I did this show, and someone from the telly came and said, come do your own TV show. It wouldn't be good, you know, in the first year. It would be a bad thing, however good you are, because you'll be better in 5 years' time. And you'll have more stuff to do, and you won't just explode and disappear, because you'll have worked up a certain amount of stuff. I would say 20-30 years really, ideally, but, you know, it's not really workable.
Yeah. You also tour pretty much after every show.
Yeah.
And I read that even in 2012, so like quite recently, you were just going around on your own, driving to places.
Yeah, yeah.
How did you deal with, like, because like I presume from an outsider point of view, people would more have a perception of, oh, he's got a touring crew and he's doing all this, you know.
Yeah, well, it's always been a small thing for me. You know, when we did Lee and Harry, we had a tour manager and a support, so there were four of us. Sometimes five of us if we had someone else along. But, yeah, no, I mean, you know, it's not economically viable to do much else. So you can, now I can afford to have a driver, and I think I need to. You know, I think once I got over, you know, once I got into my 40s, it became more difficult. I still did a couple of the tours on my own, as you say. But, you know, you're just too tired to do the shows properly, because the driving's really difficult. When you're 35, you can drive back from Yorkshire and back to Yorkshire the next day, you know, and still be okay. But it's just, you know, so in just terms of keeping the show professional, you want to not be too knackered out. And because I'm more people are coming, I can afford to pay somebody to come along with me. But yes, you know, it's a solitary, but being a comedian is a sort of solitary experience. So all that's part, you know, you're just basically doing a gig and then going to a hotel and not really, and, you know, you have an hour and a half where you interact, you know, you're interacting with loads of people, but you're not on any kind of level with them. You're not socializing with them, and you can't really socialize with them after a while, because it's too weird. So, you know, because they've just paid to come and see you, and they are a fan of what you're doing. And so if you go and have a drink with them, they'll just be asking you more about yourself, which is probably not what you want to do.
Okay.
If you're in your downtime.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, some people might want to, but I wouldn't. I don't want to go out for a drink with some comedy fans who want to talk to me about, you know, the Simon Quinlan sketch or something, you know, if after I've just done a gig. Yeah. I don't mind talking to you on Twitter about it or whatever. You know, or just being in that position where someone's going, oh, wow, you're amazing. Going, no, well, I want to have a drink now, you know. Mm. So you end up going and sitting in a hotel and having a drink on your own, or just going to bed and not being able to sleep because you're full of adrenaline, or driving home or whatever, yeah. So it's, you know, it's a solitary and weird thing, and you've got that difference between, you know, the being the centre of attention and this amazing room full of laughter and then being somewhere on your own, which is why loads of comedians go mental.
Well, I was going to ask how you deal with that mental health kind of fluctuation.
Well, you know, it's easier now. I'm a bit older and, you know, I've got a much more solid home life. So I'm working for my family and, you know, there's a reason to be doing it and I've got something to go home to. It's difficult, more difficult when you're away because you have people to miss more than you did. But I was probably more depressed when I was, you know, like 2007 maybe, when I was sort of touring on my own and had nobody at home and was nearly 40 and, you know, just getting drunk and wondering what my life was going. So, you know, that was sort of properly depressing. So, you know, you just got to get a grip of what it is, you know. So the stuff on stage isn't real. The reaction is nice, but it's not real. Either way, if it's good or bad, doesn't matter. And, you know, you're doing a job and then you're just a regular person after that job. and then you get used to your own company, I suppose, and so it's all right. I still don't love it. I don't love, you know, I try to get home if I can after gigs. I don't love staying in hotels. You know, and when you're in your 20s, it's exciting. You know, you're going, oh, wow, we get to stay in a hotel and stay out and do what we want. And, you know, we get to fly around the world. But now if someone says, do you want to go to Australia to do a gig, you kind of go, oh. You know, that's a lot of hassle. Whereas 15 years ago, wow, I get to go to Australia with my job and I don't earn anything, but I don't, you know, I'm getting a free holiday. So, you know, things change. And I think you just, you know, you become a bit more centered, but not everyone does and not everyone can cope with it. I think, again, I've been lucky because I've had a taste of like being almost famous and I've had experience of being worrying whether it's going to carry on at all. And so to be in a position where I can tour and people come and see me and I make a nice living and I have a nice family to go back to and, you know, and I'm not too worried about finances yet, you know, but you know, you never know, where I just need a bad year and it's all fucked up. But you know, so it's I think, again, you sort of appreciate how lucky you are, so you stop moping about the things that, you know, people, I mean, you see on Twitter a lot of people going, oh god, no, I've got to go and do I'm doing this and I'm doing this, I'm doing this and I'm working so hard and it's all, my life's awful. You kind of go, yeah, but that's what, you can't complain about those things, that's what you wanted. And also there's loads of people sitting, there's loads of other comedians sitting at home going, you know, I would love to be doing the things you're doing. So don't, like, make out that you're complaining. You're not really complaining about it. You're showing off about all the stuff you're doing. Yeah. So, you know, it's, you know, I think that's what you realise. You realise, you know, I think you've got to count your blessings, realise how lucky you are and stop competing with other people and only compete with yourself. And a lot of comedians can't leave that competing with other people behind. So you're never going to be happy. I talked about it in one of the shows. I may be unhappy now. About sort of seeing comedians at the Jerry Seinfeld show and the most famous comedians in the country all in this after show party, all kind of looking over their shoulders, all kind of assessing which of them was the most successful and looking at the person who was more successful and being jealous of them. And you kind of go, you've done it, you've made it, why are you still doing this? So you've got to shake off that. And you know, and so, like, it's weird. I've got a double act partner who is perceived as being a lot more successful than I am in terms of being a stand up, which I think is true. And you know, you could let that get you and destroy you, but I A, find it funny, B, I'm pleased for him on the whole. You know, it's, but also it's not, you know, the competition, if it is a competition, the competition isn't over, but it isn't a competition, and you know, there's no reason to compare yourself to other people. You've just got to keep on doing what you're doing and do it as best you can. So otherwise it would drive you nuts and destroy you. So you know, that's what I think by having some knocks and by being the self-obsessed person that most comedians are and getting over that hopefully a bit, you sort of hopefully get better at coping with loneliness and or solitude. You know, it just becomes solitude. It's not a bad thing. I've got a child, so a night in a hotel can be quite a nice break, but like two nights in a hotel, it's like, oh, I wish I was home with my family. So it's, you know, it's still not easy, but it's but you know, it would be churlish to complain about being able to travel the country and perform in my own right in my own shows and sometimes have 600 people come see me and sometimes have 60 people come see me.
In terms of I mean, does it ever annoy you when people say, you know, oh, when they compare you and Stuart Lee?
Well, it used to, and it annoys me only in that it rarely seems to be, oh, they probably have similarities because they worked together for 15 years. Or, you know, it's never like, I wonder if Stu is doing that because it's something that Richard did, you know. So there seems, sometimes it's aggravating to be when reviewers will kind of go, oh, there's clearly some influence from Stuart in this, and they never do it the other way. And, you know, and I know the truth, and I know that we both influence each other, and the reason our acts are similar is because we worked together for 15 years. I never even go, you know, I never even see his stuff because I don't want to, you know, have that hanging over you that you're being influenced by the other one. But, you know, we're never to win through a lot of the same experiences. So, but no, but, you know, it doesn't, I think you've got to look at Stuart, and he should give hope to all comedians because, you know, he's stuck to his guns and done what he wanted to do and has made it really, you know, done it very successfully and hasn't had to compromise. So he's a kind of beacon of hope that you could do that and still be successful. Mm. So, you know, I'm not, it's insane. And also there's lots of, you know, I think as a stand-up, yeah, he's an amazing, you know, but we do what we do is still very different. But he's also done stand up for 15 years longer than I have. You know, comedy isn't just stand up, and there's other things that I think I'm better at than him at, and other things that, you know. So it's a whole picture. But also, I think it's about how happy you are in yourself, anyway. So you know, I can look at all the stuff I've done in my career and be quite proud of the stuff I've achieved. And so I'm not going to let any, you know, other people want you to be angry and want you to be bitter about it. And I'm not saying I've never been, you know, jealous or envious, but you just get to a point where there's no point in doing that. And, you know, I'd much rather be me than him. So.
Fair enough.
So, yeah.
How do you not get bored of doing your show?
Well, because you concentrate on making it better every night. So the technical challenge of it becomes really interesting. And so even if you do exactly the same stuff every night, it's different every night because the audience is different. And also you find a different way to do it. But you're basically juggling 10 or 15 different things as a performer. So there's the words, there's the way you say them, there's the way, the pauses, there's how you hold your body, there's how you gesture, you know, there's all these different ways of doing stuff, you know, and delivering a line in a different way. Last night in Camberley, it was sort of like a really tiny gig again. And I just, you know, you're finding, you know, doing a routine I've done maybe 300 or 400 times and just finding new ways of lightening it or darkening it or saying, you know, just the tone of it, not even changing the words. Sometimes you change the words. So, you know, I find that idea of trying to perfect the show, and that's what's fun about it. You're doing it night after night, and you can remember what you did last night, hopefully, or half remember what you did last night and think, oh, can I capture that again? So you just, by concentrating on the technical aspect of it, I think, and by trying to become better at what you're doing, then it sort of is a fascinating exercise for you. And certainly 10 or 15 years ago, that wasn't the case. I'd get bored of a show and annoyed if the audience weren't with me, and rush through it if the audience didn't seem to be on my side. But now I will just, you know, if his audience isn't going for it, I would be trying harder to make them go for it and trying to make them have a good time. I think, again, I've much more got to the point where I've realised people have paid money to see me, which is an amazing privilege. But also I should be giving, this is their night off, you know. And as a parent, you suddenly go, that could be their one night off a month or a year or, you know, every 6 months or whatever. So I want to entertain them. And if they're having a bad time, I've got to try and turn that around and make it into a good time for them. So not get angry with the people who turned up to see you. If it's a small number of people, they're the people who came to see you. So you've got to make them feel good. But yeah, I just think I'm fascinated by trying to become better at what I'm doing all the time. And you do, you know, every 6 months think, ah, now I get it. And then 6 months later, I go, oh, no, now I get it. So you become just better and better at what you're doing. So, again, you know, I'm really lucky because, you know, I could have done Talking Cock very easily. That could have been like, hey, come and do a show on TV about cocks and then present this and then present this and then be on this game show and this panel show. And I would probably never have done stand-up again. But because I've maintained this level of being good enough for people to come and see me and well-known for people to come and see me, but not well-known enough to be taken off to do other stuff, I'm hopefully getting just really, really good at being a stand-up comedian by just doing it again and again. And it wasn't what I wanted to do. You know, it wasn't what I was interested in when I started. I wanted to, you know, so I'd probably like to be someone like David Mitchell, you know, when I started. I'd like to be doing panel shows and and sitcoms and, you know, and just being kind of a witty bon viveur. Now I see myself as a stand-up, you know. And so it's, you know, you just keep pushing yourself to get better and better, and you get better at it by doing it. And, you know, I've done 12 shows, 12 different shows in 15 years, which most people just don't get the opportunity to do, because either you become too successful or not successful enough. And even like this, you know, Jimmy Carr done 15 shows. But, you know, it's very rare for someone successful to do that much work. And also it's very rare for, you know, that's why Stu's good again, because he always writes his own stuff, which most of them don't when they become that successful. But again, I think that's really important. You become better as a writer, you become better as a performer. And, you know, by putting your heart and soul into it, then it means something. And it's not just turning up and, you know, reciting someone else's jokes.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, so that's the understanding how fortunate I am and always striving to be better at what I do. Because, you know, I've never been that kind of personality who would think, oh, I'm the best, I'm fantastic. I've always been like quite the opposite of, like, you know, people don't need to criticize me because I will be doing that myself. So then you use that to keep pushing yourself and get better. So, you know, I'm glad that I was never the act coming off going, yeah, I stormed it, I was the best tonight. I would always come off, even if I was the best, I wouldn't have known it. I wouldn't have noticed, because I would have been too critical of what I'm doing. But that self-criticism, as long as it's not self-destructive, is how you become better at what you're doing. So, you know, performing is just amazing, weird. It's a weird thing. And I've just got like a voice, you know, half the time you're just commentating in your head about how weird this is, what a strange way to make a living. The tightrope of it, you know, why are people, you know, what if people didn't laugh and they are laughing? Isn't that fucking amazing? You're making all these strangers in a room laugh. And how have I done that? And, you know, and that, will it stop? And can you, you know, I have a very critical voice in my head that's trying to ruin the show for me as well. So it's I find all that stuff fascinating. But I think, just, you know, it'd be nice. I hope I do get another 20 or 30 years at it, because it'd be just great. I'd love to see how good I am at the end of it. I might not be as good, but I think generally you do get better, and you're learning all the time. And you know, that's the things that annoy me about review. You'll get a reviewer in who will sort of criticize and say, oh, you know, he doesn't understand this about comedy, doesn't understand that about comedy. You go, you know, I know a lot more about comedy than A, I do it, but B, I've really thought about things. So the choices I've made aren't casual.
Yeah.
Even if you disagree with the choices, or even if, you know, that's a bit of an obvious thing to go, well, you know, if you think it's obvious, then maybe I think it's obvious, and maybe I'm doing it for another reason than you're assuming. So maybe you're not clever enough to get why I'm doing it.
Yeah.
So, you know, so a lot of critics will be like, oh, he's done something about this subject, and that's very hack. And you go, no, subject's hack. Subject's hack. It's the way you do it that's hack. You can't say the subject, loads of comedians are doing that subject.
Yeah.
So Brexit, you can't say loads of comedians are doing Brexit, so that's a rubbish joke. It's a better joke if you come up with it. If everyone's doing it, you come up with the right joke about it. It's a brilliant joke.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's loads of ways that you kind of, you know, it's a weird thing that not many people would be confident enough to be so critical. So many unqualified people would be comfortable to be that critical of someone who was that practiced as something. But, you know, I suppose that is the critic's job. But you know, I think it's... I think all comedians, and even the ones you don't like and the ones you think are rubbish, generally think very hard about what they're doing, and have come to a decision to do that for a reason.
Yeah.
It might not be the right reason, or it might not be the right reason for you, but it's maybe the right reason for them. So, you know, and I think comedians think much more about stuff than most people think they do.
No, I was only laughing because there's the third joke in my current show. I did a thing last night,
right.
And it's where I say there's a rule where you have to start with your second best joke and end with your best joke.
Yeah.
So what comes now is about 46 minutes of filler.
Yeah.
And this person came up to me afterwards and went, you should not end on that joke, it's too good to end on. And I was like, I said at the start, you've got to wait for it, but it's going to be worth it. And it was like, what are you, don't give me that feedback. Like, that's exactly what I was working towards.
So. But you know, you might not get it right. It's good to have critics, and it's good not to assume you definitely know what you're doing. But I think it's a sort of weird thing where people will, I mean, that's that they don't make the leap to think, well, maybe he's doing it for a reason, or maybe, you know, maybe he knows as much about comedy as I do and knows this already. So maybe there's something else that I should be thinking about. You know, you could. But that's the problem with comedies, is back and forth. So you're double bluffing and bluffing and double triple bluffing and going back and forth. So, you know, you could be subverting something and people think you're doing the thing.
Do you think a negative review affects you as much as it would have done in your earlier career?
No, but sometimes they still do. Sometimes just weirdly. Most of them I completely just laugh off. But occasionally something will just get you, just weirdly. So it's, you know, and it'll just then nag every time that bit comes up. There'll be that thing nagging at you in the voice, whatever it was, a tweet or something, you know. But mostly not at all. And weirdly, often from idiotic comments from people who don't know what they're talking about will just make me so angry that that it will then affect that bit. And I might have to even drop it because I'm, you know, because then it isn't funny because then I'm delivering it wrong. So, but mostly, you get to a point where you really, you know, people think, like on Twitter, I'm going to tell you the truth and I don't think you're funny. You go, do you think I think everyone thinks I'm funny? You know, because I really don't. I sort of am surprised if anyone thinks I'm funny. So, you know, I'm not disappointed if someone doesn't. And I'd be disappointed if everyone found me funny anyway, because that would be weird. But, you know, it's not your opinion might matter to you, but it doesn't really matter that much to me. If nobody found me funny, that's a problem. Mm. But like, you know, even if, you know, most people don't know who I am, and most people wouldn't find me funny, but that doesn't matter. As long as, you know, there's this core of people who do find me funny, and I find me funny, that's all that matters. So, you know, most of those criticisms, you just think, well, you're weird because you think your opinion means that much. Mm. And I think, again, the older you get, the more I kind of just think those subjective things, like a taste in music or comedy or whatever, are so stupid that you could, if you know, that's fine. That's your subjective opinion. But to then think, oh, it makes me better than other people because I like this, is crazy. Because it's like nothing, it's not important anyway. It's not important what band you like. So liking a different band to, you know, people always didn't like Phil Collins, and you go, oh, if you like Phil Collins, you're naff. But, you know, you're still just, it's all just tinky, tinkle, tinkle, isn't it? And I don't like music, so that's why I think, you know, people like getting really obsessed about which music is best. You kind of think it's all just rubbish. So, you know, what your rubbish is still as rubbish as that other person's rubbish. So, you know, I think to get upset about opinion is odd. But, yeah, sometimes something, for some reason, infuriates you. But usually, no, I don't mind. And I quite like to get, criticism that you go, yeah, I think that is right. I think there is something in that. So those things don't annoy me. It's the ones that where I feel aggrieved. It's like when I feel people haven't understood that I know more about comedy than they do. But things like that I can obsess about.
I'm into as in audience ticket wise rather than personally, but that's interesting.
Yeah.
I don't
think it does. I don't think, you know, again, I don't think.
Do you think people read the reviews anymore?
Yeah, but I think, you know, a lot of times you get a bad review and people go, oh, that was a good review. And, you know, I saw your review and so I came to see you because I saw your review. I got a 3-star review in the Times. It was terrible. No, I saw it. It's 3 stars. That was good. So, you know, it's a different perception, but it's also just publicity for your show, you know. So even if I see a bad review for something, often I don't like the reviewer and I go, oh, I didn't know that thing was on. I'll go and see that. So, you know, it's that. I don't think it. I mean, if you get stinkers, but if you get real stinkers, then more people come anyway because, you know, they want to see this terrible show. So I don't think it. I think if you get loads of good reviews, that can impact on your ticketing. But I don't think the reviews really. You know, I got, when I did Lord of the Dance, I got really good write ups. So I got amazing review in The Scotsman. I got pretty good reviews on that, you know, given it's Edinburgh and most of the reviews are written by people who've never seen comedy before. You know, I got really good reviews and it didn't make any, you know, didn't get any more ticket sales as a result.
Okay.
So there's something more to it than that, you know. I think there's definitely like a hill you're climbing and then it gets you rolling down the other side, but it's it doesn't necessarily follow. But I don't think a bad review, well, who knows, I don't know. It's hard to say, isn't it? Because the people don't come if they don't come, so you don't know if they would have come. But, you know, I always, it seems to me, regardless, I always get sort of the number of people that I get, and it sometimes goes up a bit, sometimes it levels out for a little while. But I don't think it's anything to do with the reviews.
And in terms of staying in contact with your fans,
yeah,
obviously you're on quite a lot of different platforms. Do you like being on social media? Does it annoy you too much?
I used to really love it, and when Twitter started, it was amazing. And you know, I like chatting about comedy to people who like comedy, and I like fans of mine, and you know, that's all positive. And I don't even mind people who don't like it. I don't understand. I kind of find it fascinating that someone would seek you out to tell you they don't like you. I think that's more interesting than them not liking you. So I kind of quite enjoy the trolls to an extent as well. I think it's fun. I think most of it's really good. After a gig, if I'm in a hotel bar and I'll dick around for a bit with people and people will join in, I think that's a really lovely social thing. And yeah, I think for me, the internet and being in with all Twitter and social media has definitely helped me keep the kind of fan base that I don't think I would have, without the podcasts, I'm not sure to what level I would be working still. I mean, I think I'd still be in the business, but I don't think I'd be, without doing the podcast, without Chris Evans filming my gigs, without coming back to do stand-up, but, I don't know where my career would be without the podcasts, really.
Yeah, I was going to ask about, I met Chris the other day, I was in Cardiff, and yeah, we were talking about Go Faster, and I was wondering, what impact personally and professionally you've benefited from.
Yeah, I mean, it's been amazing because he does all the stupid things I want to do, but also just being able to have your show at the end of the tour, Christ and Mike and Twin Cock, I thought were great shows and they just disappeared and no one ever wanted to film them and then they were gone, and that was just depressing. But then just to think, oh, it still exists, someone can still find it now if they want to find it, it's just really nice. So it just means there's that thing, it still exists, I can still go back and look at it and relearn it if I want to do it again, it feels like a big deal. And then you're getting new fans and you're getting a bit more revenue from it, increasingly less because DVDs aren't really selling, but it's not really about that, it's more about the having Chris and having that means to film things cheaply and having someone keen to make things happen who isn't interested in anything other than making comedy that he likes, it's just amazing. So I think without that and without doing the podcasts and I don't know, I mean, I'd probably be writing, I think I'd probably be doing comedy, I'm not sure I'd be performing as much. It's hard to know, isn't it? I mean, if I hadn't got to the point where touring became, it became a way of me earning enough money to live on for the year, really, by doing 3 or 4 months touring. But it would, 10 years ago, it certainly wasn't that. Then without that, I don't know where I'd be, because it means that I can do all the free stuff and I earn money still for the rest of the year, but from other things. But it just gives you that freedom. And I don't think I'd have, without the podcast, I wouldn't have the audience. And I think without Chris, maybe I wouldn't have have that as well.
Okay, you quick fire for me, you take as long as you need, but obviously, yeah, fair enough.
Okay.
What is the best show you've ever seen?
difficult to say. Billy Connolly did it. We went to see him in the late 90s do a show at the Hammersmith Apollo, which was just a real masterclass in keeping a big audience engaged but still doing crazy sprawling stories. So that's probably, that was one of the ones, certainly.
Okay. What is the biggest mistake you've ever made and how did you overcome it?
It's hard. It's hard to quantify. But again, I think it's that the making whatever the mistakes are, they're more important than the things you do well. So you overcome them by learning from them and moving on. We were writing on the day to day and we ended up not writing on the day to day. But I think the reasons we ended up not writing on it were good. But it felt like a disaster at the time because it felt like, and was, it sort of, I was correct, it felt like we were absenting ourselves from the Monty Python of our generation, which we sort of were. Then you get on and do something else.
Cool. Who is the most underrated person in the comedy industry?
It is me. there's loads of, someone that's brilliant, loads of so brilliant comedians, Simon Munnery, Bruce B. Gratho is fantastic. There's loads of people who are great and they don't push themselves in the same way as the people who are successful do. So most people will never hear of them. I think Simon Munnery is, might be, aside from him not, he doesn't always come up with loads of new stuff, but the stuff he does is just so phenomenally good. But he's not, he's not interested in the world that, getting to that other side of the world. So, he wants to be this figure that he is, I suppose. So maybe okay. Maybe he's rated correctly. I don't know.
What is the biggest problem in the comedy industry and how would you go about solving it?
I mean, there's loads of stuff, but I think lots of people are looking for reasons that they themselves are not doing too well or why they, why they've been overlooked. And I think just you've just got to get on with what you do and enjoy it for itself. So I think probably, you know, that the comedian's own attitude is as much as a problem as all the things that are annoying and are wrong. I think, you know, in TV terms, not. I think what I would change is I would go back to just the executives choose people they think are funny and think they know can do stuff and then just let them get on with it. And I think that that's what's really changed on TV comedy. And that's why Stewart's an exception, that he's been, you know, all the things that go, Armando Iannucci, let him fucking get on with it and he'll produce fantastic stuff for you. And that shit, Ricky Gervais, let him get on with it and, you know, he'll make what he makes. And, you know, so you've just got to, they've got, their job should be to choose the people who are good, not to tell them the people what they should be doing or putting together teams of people. You know, you should be trusting the talent, really. And I think if you do trust the right talent, you'll get the best shows.
Okay, last question. Mm-hmm. If you could go back to any point in your career,
yeah,
and give yourself one bit of advice you wish you had at the time, what would it have been?
Well, you know, but all the things I did wrong and that I still do wrong, I don't think I'd want to change anything. You know, I think it was all, you know, I'm not good at networking, I'm not good at pushing myself, and just trying to think if there's any point that I could have gone back and changed anything. You know, so I wouldn't go back to the day-to-day and say you should do the day-to-day, because I think it was probably right for us that we didn't. You know, and what you lose, it's what all my time travel stuff's about. What you lose is so much. You don't know where you would end up. If you, even if you would made yourself incredibly successful, you might not be as happy. I don't know. Kill Stuart Lee the first time I met him.
Okay.
That would be it. No, I'm joking. I don't know. I wouldn't really want to change anything. And it's... It's sort of weird because, you know, I think if you'd asked me 15 years ago, I'd change loads of stuff. But maybe just be more confident. Maybe carry on doing stand-up. But again, I think if I had carried on doing stand-up, I would have been a different person as well. Maybe I should have persevered when I hated doing stand-up in the early 1990s. But, you know, why force yourself to do something you're not ready to do? And would it have worked? Would I have... been the person I am now if I'd done that? So I think you just have to be quite fatalistic about it. Once things have happened, I think you can affect things in the future. Be better at remembering who executives are. So when you see them a second time, you go hello to them rather than not realizing who they are. But I still can't do that. No. I'm not a good person to ask someone successful what they would do, because that's why they're successful.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for
thank
coming.
Thank you. No problem.
That was Richard. I love his work ethic. I love how he manages so many projects and family life and just manages to keep motivated and keep going, even with his struggles and anxieties. And just, I feel like everyone could learn something from him. I feel like I have a lot of friends who complain about writer's block, who complain about, you know, sort of self-imposed deadlines and not being able to sort of stick to them. And I think it's a good habit to get into. The fact that he's able to stick to deadlines, the fact that he's able to push himself and go, right, how many projects can I do? How many podcasts can I make? Why should I wait for a TV commissioner to give me the permission to do this when I can make it and put it up myself? And if I get enough people to donate to it, I might even be able to break even on it. So that's something I love. That's an ethic that I really stick behind. That's something that I'm doing as best I can and hopefully building an audience for myself. I hope you got something out of that. I hope you found it as motivating and as inspiring as I did. I can't thank him enough for giving up his time and for supporting the podcast. If you want to thank him, his Twitter handle is in the show notes, so please do go and thank him. It really helps out to thank the guest, because it means if I need to ask a previous guest to put on another guest or to put me in touch with a future guest, they're more receptive to do it, because they're like, oh, there's a really good audience there that are listening to the episodes and are really appreciative. So if you can, and if you're on Twitter, please do tweet him and say thank you if you got any value out of it. As I said before, myself and Richard are both at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. Richard is at the Pleasance Courtyard every single day at 7:30 p.m. doing a show called Oh Frig, I'm 50. The prices will vary on the day depending on whether it's a 2-for-1 or a special offer or whatever. Have a look in the show notes, you'll be able to find him. He's also doing a tour after the Fringe. I am at the Edinburgh Fringe in the Suites venue every day except Wednesday, when I get rudely awoken by the dustman. At 5 p.m. It's £5 if you want to reserve a seat, or it is pay what you want on exit. So please do come and support me. It would be really, really appreciated, as I put a lot of work into these, and if you like hearing my voice, you might like seeing my face as well. So yeah, please do support me. If you can't do that, if you're new, please do subscribe. If you're old, please do give us an honest review in iTunes. They really help. I need to find new ways of saying these, but yeah, they do help, and they mean a lot. They help chart positionings. They also help with future guests to know that there are people coming on, and it's just useful. Just seriously, leave a review. It doesn't take very long. You can do it now while I'm talking. I don't mind. Also, you can donate money to the podcast to keep it going. The website is simonkane.co.uk. There you can donate a one-off on PayPal, or you can just sign up as a Patreon, which means you give a certain amount per episode, which starts at $1, because it's an American site. $1 is about 80p. If you think this is worth 80p, please chuck it my way. If you want to give more than that, if you want to give more than a fiver, do consider just buying my book. My book's called How to Make a Living by Working for Free, and it is about building a community around your free content online and asking them to support you in order to keep it going, much like what I'm doing right now. So if you'd like to buy a copy of that, there's hardback copies of the book, but there's also digital downloads from £5. So if you'd like to do that, you can. It gives you something back for your money. That'd be really great. That'd be lovely. Thank you so much. That's all for me from now. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for donating. And thank you very much for coming to see me at the Edinburgh Fringe, if you do. I'll see you all in about 15 days' time. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.